content of this program was intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 12th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the Supreme Court building. There's a dark background, dark sky with lightning flashing. The facade actually looks to be crumbling with cracks coming right down the front steps. And on the side to the right of the steps is an angry crowd saying, "Confirm Kavanaugh" signs and yelling across the aisle. And on the other side of the steps is another angry crowd with signs that say, "Kava, nope." And not surprisingly, that is our main story. The title is Supreme Schism, the divisive battle over Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Main stories and how they were covered. The FBI's Kavanaugh investigation. What happened? Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court hung in the balance this week as the FBI conducted an investigation into the sexual assault allegations against him at the insistence of wavering Republican senators. After hearing emotional testimony from both Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford, who has accused the judge of sexually assaulting her when they were both teenagers, Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona said the issue of who is telling the truth is tearing the country apart, and that he could not vote for Kavanaugh without further clarification from the FBI. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska joined Flake in backing an investigation. But House Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he would call for a vote as soon as the FBI concluded its expanded background check. "The time for endless delay and obstruction has come to a close," McConnell said. President Trump ordered the FBI to conduct an investigation into the allegations from Blasey Ford, as well as from Deborah Ramirez, a former Yale classmate who has accused Kavanaugh of exposing himself to her at a college party. But the FBI reportedly was not given authority to look into Kavanaugh's drinking habits in high school and college, or whether he told the truth during his Senate testimony. Initially, the White House provided the Bureau with a list of only four witnesses to question. After backlash from Democrats, the White House clarified that the FBI could interview anyone agents felt necessary, as long as the investigation wrapped up within 1 week. Ramirez's attorney, John Clune, said she provided more than 20 names to the FBI, but there's no indication that the FBI had contacted any of them. "We have great concern that the FBI is not conducting or being permitted to conduct a serious investigation," Clune said. The FBI's report was due to be sent to the Senate after the week went to press. What the editorial said. "Democrats got what they wanted by delaying the vote on Kavanaugh," said WashingtonExaminer.com. "Their real agenda is to prevent Trump from filling the seat until they hope they take over the Senate in midterm elections. Then they'll refuse to confirm anyone until 2020. If the FBI doesn't find any proof of the sexual assault allegations, Democrats will undoubtedly move the goalposts and say the Bureau wasn't given enough time or manpower or resources. But it's impossible for the FBI or Kavanaugh to prove he's innocent. And if no evidence of guilt is found, the Senate must disregard the accusation and promptly confirm an excellent nominee. Whatever happens next, Republican lawmakers ought to tread carefully," said the New York Times. Blasey Ford's wrenching testimony has inspired legions of women to share their own experiences with sexual assault. In response, Republican men have largely shrugged their shoulders, and even worse, dismissed Blasey Ford as hopelessly confused, a political pawn, or a liar. The real danger, President Trump and many Republicans say, is that good men like Kavanaugh will be destroyed by false accusations. This is straight-up culture warfare. What the columnists say. President Trump's defense of Kavanaugh is entirely based on male victimhood, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. At a rally in Mississippi this week, Trump mocked Blasey Ford's testimony outright, adding that this is a very scary time for young men in America. This isn't about Kavanaugh anymore. It's about heeding the primal scream of a white male GOP base that feels its power and prestige slipping away. Kavanaugh's confirmation fight has become a trial over masculinity itself, said Jeet Heer in the NewRepublic.com. To defend Kavanaugh, Republicans are insisting that reports of his heavy drinking and belligerent behavior in high school and college only show he's a typical guy, and are blaming the Me Too movement for demonizing men. Republicans have a clear choice, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. They either confirm Kavanaugh now or bow in total capitulation to the left's agenda. Liberals are dying to make a scapegoat of a white male Catholic conservative who belonged to an Ivy League frat and just might be the deciding vote the next time there's a legal challenge to Roe v. Wade. Flake actually did Kavanaugh a favor, said David Markison, TheFederalist.com. If the FBI comes back with nothing, which seems likely, it will deflate the allegations against him and restore Kavanaugh's legitimacy as a Supreme Court justice. That is no small thing. This fight over this nomination completes the GOP's transformation into Trump's party, said Josh Krashauer in NationalJournal.com. Kavanaugh, a card-carrying member of the Bush-era Republican establishment, embraced Trump's no-holds-bar partisanship in defending himself. Even anti-Trump conservatives have flocked to defend the judge, seeing it as an existential struggle against left-wing smears. After the nomination fight and the November midterms are over, the political polarization will only get worse. Voters will be faced with a binary choice heading into 2020. Join the party of Trump or be a part of the resistance. And we will take in the second main story this week. Trump touts his NAFTA replacement. What happened? President Trump was celebrating his administration's renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement with Canada and Mexico this week, calling the updated pact a boon to the U.S. economy and a vindication of his hard-nosed negotiating tactics. Speaking at the White House, Trump said that the New Deal, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, would send cash and jobs pouring into the U.S. If approved by legislatures in all three nations, the USMCA will replace the 24-year-old NAFTA, which Trump has long derided as the worst deal ever, saying it sent jobs overseas and wrecked the Rust Belt. He attributed the renegotiation, which took 13 months and was completed just hours before a U.S.-imposed deadline, to his willingness to play tough with America's neighbors. Without tariffs, he said, we wouldn't be talking about a deal. For cars and trucks to qualify for zero tariffs under USMCA, at least 75% of their parts will need to be made in North America by 2020, up from NAFTA's 62.5%. By 2023, 40% of a car or a truck's production will also have to be completed by workers earning at least $16 per hour, three times what the average Mexican auto worker currently makes. The deal will also see Canada open 3.6 of its closely protected dairy sector to U.S. imports and let U.S. drug companies sell pharmaceuticals for 10 years in Canada before facing generic competition, up from 8 years under NAFTA. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called the agreement a good deal, but admitted to trade-offs. Like any important negotiation, he said, we had to make compromises. What the editorial said, this could have been worse, said the Washington Post. If Trump had followed through on his threats to scrap NAFTA entirely, hemispheric supply chains would have collapsed. Thankfully, he retreated from the brink with respect to America's second and third largest trading partners, Canada and Mexico, and settled for minor tweaks to the deal. The resulting agreement is more managed trade than free trade, but that's a price worth paying if it preserves economic stability in the Western Hemisphere. Trump can be incredibly wrong-headed on trade, said the Washington Examiner, but no one can take this win away from him. He cleverly forced Canada to bow to his will, striking a deal first with Mexico and then telling Trudeau to take it or leave it. The USMCA itself isn't much of an improvement on NAFTA, but it has certain advantages. The U.S. agricultural industry, in particular, will get greater access to foreign markets. So one cheer, perhaps two, for the new trade agreement. What the columnists said. Well, that was unnecessarily painful, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. Trump has alienated allies and punished our farmers and manufacturers with devastating tariffs, only to end up with a trade deal that looks an awful lot like the old one. The sections he did rewrite could backfire on the U.S. The updated rules of origin for autos may end up being so costly to adhere to that they'll encourage manufacturers to move more of their operations outside North America. Experts said it was crazy to attack NAFTA, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. But Trump was proved right. Flush with success, he's now likely to be less deferential to aides and advisors as he gains even more confidence in the power of his intuition and bargaining ability. The president is only getting started in his plan to refashion the Western global order, said Krishnadev Kalamur in TheAtlantic.com. And though they may not like it, U.S. trade partners have little choice but to go along with much of what the world's largest economy wants. With China and Russia as the only viable alternatives to the U.S., global order, many countries will begrudgingly accept Pax Americana. Still, the USMCA is far from a done deal, said Megan Casella in Politico.com. A vote in Congress isn't expected until 2019, and if Democrats win control of either chamber in the midterms, they could reject the pact and deny a president they despise anything even closely resembling a policy victory. As one former Senate aide said, it'll be too much fun for them to just kill it off on day one. Controversy of the week, no surprise. Kavanaugh, was his display of anger justified? Brett Kavanaugh may or may not have assaulted Christine Blasey Ford at a high school gathering in 1982, said Greg Weiner in the New York Times. But the injudicious temperament he displayed at last week's hearings should nonetheless doom his nomination. The eruption of Mount Kavanaugh began with the judge's opening statement, a vindictive, spluttering diatribe against a conspiracy of Democrats and left-wing opposition groups who blackened his name as payback for President Trump's election and to get revenge on behalf of the Clintons. With sneering sarcasm, Kavanaugh demanded that Senators Sheldon Whitehouse and Amy Klobuchar share details of their own drinking habits before answering their relevant questions about his high school debauchery. Veering from fury to sniveling sobs, Kavanaugh came across as an angry brat and entitled self-pitying frat boy, said Roger Cohen, also in the Times. His falsehood-ridden testimony blurred into one long primal scream for threatened white male privilege. Kavanaugh's rage was entirely justified, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Days before a vote that would have elevated him to the Supreme Court, the capstone of a distinguished judicial career, Democrats and the media accused him of being a violent drunk and a gang rapist. When no actual evidence surfaced to corroborate those claims, liberals turned to this desperate temperament argument. Even if he's innocent, Kavanaugh is disqualified for reacting to outrageous allegations with, well, outrage. Kavanaugh's passion was magnificent and utterly convincing, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. This was clearly an innocent man defending his reputation from smears. Kavanaugh also channeled the anger simmering just beneath the surface among tens of millions of American men and women who are sick of the Democratic activist media triangle routinely destroying conservative lives for political gain. Only men are considered more credible when they display volcanic anger, said Lily Loofboro in Slate.com. Only conservatives could find Kavanaugh's extraordinary tantrum not just acceptable, but corroborating. Had the soft-spoken Blasey Ford shown even a hint of anger over what Kavanaugh allegedly did to her, the right would have read it as proof of her pathology and brokenness and dismissed her accusations as hysterical. Kavanaugh actually did himself no favors by dropping his apolitical umpire's mask, said Lawrence Tribe in the New York Times. He not only displayed a strikingly injudicious temperament, but also revealed himself as a rank partisan with deep personal animosity toward liberals. If he's confirmed, what happens when one of those left-wing opposition groups he denounced comes before the Supreme Court? Will he use his new power to take his revenge? What goes around, a bitter Kavanaugh said in a warning to Democrats, comes around. If Kavanaugh is innocent, he has every right to be indignant, said Charles Sykes in the WeeklyStandard.com. But there are appropriate and inappropriate ways of expressing anger, especially when you're applying for a lifetime job refereeing America's deepest political and cultural disputes. In his partisan rant about Clinton-connected conspiracies, Kavanaugh sounded like Sean Hannity, not Felix Frankfurter. His presence on the Supreme Court will only deepen the growing perception it is no less partisan than Congress or the White House. The image Kavanaugh left of himself is likely to be indelible, and the damage will last for decades. And we will move into our good week, bad week segment. Seems as though it was a good week for people who like beer, who for the first time since 1935 can now buy normal strength beer in Oklahoma grocery stores instead of the low point beer with an alcohol content of 3.2%. It's kind of a brave new world for everybody, said Brett Robinson, president of Beer Distributors of Oklahoma. It was a good week for country lawyers after a court in Maine agreed to grant a defendant's request for a delay of trial on the grounds that he'd been attacked and injured by a moose. His lawyer, John Steed, described the ruling as basically the highlight of my legal career. And it was a good week for ordering in after Irish prison officials discovered a trove of empty food containers from a local Chinese restaurant in an exercise yard trash can. There's no other conceivable way a Chinese takeaway could get into the prison other than by a drone, an official said. But it was a bad week for North Carolinians, who are facing a plague of mosquitoes hatching in the floodwaters left behind Hurricane Florence, including members of the species Soraphora ciliata, which are the size of a quarter and have a bite that feels like you're being stabbed. It was a bad week for modern dogs, with new research suggesting that dogs crave eye contact and become depressed and anxious when their owners spend too much time staring at smartphones. And finally, it was a bad week for name recognition, after a new poll found that about a third of voters do not know the names of their own party's candidate for Congress in November. That doesn't much matter, said political science professor Mark Hetherington, since people aren't voting for their side as much as they are voting against the other side. And before we move on, we'll take a boring but important item titled EPA Moves to Weaken Mercury Rule. The Trump administration this week finalized a proposal to dramatically roll back an Obama-era regulation covering mercury, a toxic material emitted from coal-burning power plants. The Environmental Protection Agency considers the mercury rule to be the most expensive clean air regulation ever in terms of cost to industry, with a total price tag of $9.6 billion per year. Regulators and industry have argued about how much benefit the mercury regulation produce. While the regulators have argued, the rules have created as much as $90 billion in health savings. The power industry has claimed just $1 in health savings for every $1,500 in cost. The proposal would use a narrower and more industry-friendly calculation of health benefits. And on the briefing page, still talking about the Supreme Court, we have the evolution of the Supreme Court. The nation's highest court dominates our politics, but it didn't start out so powerful. How did the founders view the court? While the Constitutional Convention of 1787 agonized over the specific powers delegated to the legislative and executive branches, the framers devoted relatively little energy to the judiciary, leaving its powers mostly vague and undefined. Alexander Hamilton argued that the judiciary would be the least dangerous branch, with the justices dependent on Congress for their salaries and budget. Without the purse or the sword, Hamilton maintained, the court's rulings would depend neither on force nor will, but merely judgment, with the new court's power resting in its prestige. During the first years of its existence, the Supreme Court heard only four cases. When John Jay, the first Chief Justice, resigned in 1795 to become governor of New York, newspapers framed the move as a promotion. The court, Jay complained, lacked energy, weight, and dignity. When did that change? With John Marshall, the nation's fourth Chief Justice, appointed in 1801, the 45-year-old Virginian almost immediately began carving out a more prominent role for the Supreme Court. In the landmark Marbury v. Madison, 1803, Marshall asserted the court's power to strike down laws passed by Congress as unconstitutional. It is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is, Marshall wrote, establishing judicial review as a keystone of American constitutional law. The Marshall Court also shaped much of the federal system that we know today, repeatedly ruling that federal laws are superior to state laws. This enraged small government-minded politicians, such as then-President Thomas Jefferson, who accused the Marshall Court of judicial overreach. The Constitution, Jefferson wrote, is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please. Who succeeded Marshall? After 34 years as Chief Justice, Marshall gave way to Roger B. Taney, who came from a family of slaveholding Maryland tobacco planters. In one of the most infamous decisions in Supreme Court history, Dred Scott v. Sandford, 1857, the court ruled against Dred Scott, an enslaved man from Missouri who sued for his freedom. Blacks, Taney wrote, could not be citizens and had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. The court further ruled that the federal government could not restrict slavery in the territories, striking down the Missouri Compromise of 1820. What was the impact of Dred Scott? It was a disaster. Taney had hoped to end the bitter national debate over slavery by making it settled law. Instead, the court's decision further polarized the country, emboldening Southern slaveholders while hardening opposition to slavery and tarnishing the court's reputation in the North. When Taney ruled against President Abraham Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus for suspected Confederate partisans during the Civil War, Lincoln ignored the order. Taney feared that the White House might even try to arrest him as well, with Northern newspapers accusing him of treason. In 1863, congressional Republicans added a 10th justice to the bench to ensure more pro-Union rulings. When did the court settle on 9 justices? After fluctuating between 6 and 10 justices, Congress in 1869 set the number at 9. And it has remained there since. But tension over the court's makeup continued. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, conservative courts struck down progressive legislation on child labor, minimum wages, and shorter work weeks. The conflict came to a head in the 1930s when the court stymied much of President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal legislation. Roosevelt pushed Congress to add as many as 6 new justices to create a liberal majority, railing against the Supreme Court as 9 old men. Roosevelt's court packing scheme met with bipartisan backlash and was ultimately shelved after swing vote Justice Owen Roberts started to vote with the court's liberal bloc. Roberts' sudden shift, apparently a strategic attempt to save the court's integrity, has been dubbed the switch in time that saved 9. What about confirmation hearings? For years, hearings were held only for controversial nominees, with most nominees confirmed on a voice vote. The first public hearings were held in 1916 for President Woodrow Wilson's nominee, Louis Brandeis. The first Jewish Supreme Court justice. Confirmation hearings became a regular part of the nomination process only after the court ruled segregation unconstitutional in Brown v. Board of Education, 1954, increasing public interest in the court's impact on daily life. Brown was a 9-0 ruling, but in recent decades, the court has become increasingly polarized, especially in major culturally controversial cases. Before 1940, fewer than 2% of the court's decisions were decided by one vote. Since then, it's been about 16%. The current court has decided 21.5% of its cases by a 5-4 ruling. Chief Justice John Roberts himself has said that if the court is perceived as clearly divided along partisan lines, it's going to lose its credibility and legitimacy as an institution. ¶¶ and we'll read a few of the best columns. Why people don't have hobbies. More and more Americans say they have no hobbies, said Tim Wu. Part of the reason is that we are also very busy, but the deeper reason is the growing expectation that we must be skilled at what we do in our free time. That everything in this intensely public, performative age reflects on your identity. If you're a jogger, it is no longer enough to cruise around the block. You're training for the marathon. If you paint or write or play the guitar or do carpentry, you better be good enough to display your skills publicly. This is a terrible shame. There is a pure childlike delight in learning something new, without the burden of excellence or self-judgment. What if you decide in your 40s, as I have, that you want to learn to surf, or to learn to speak Italian in your 60s? Even becoming minimally competent is highly rewarding. Our affluent technological era is supposed to free us from the struggle to just to survive, so that we have time to pursue purpose, joy, and contentment. Why cheat ourselves out of one of life's greatest rewards, doing something that you merely, but truly, enjoy? And before we get the other columns, I saw a picture in the It Must Be True. I read it in the tabloids section, and I've just got to read the article. It shows a pair of goats hanging from some sort of airlift situation, so let's see what it says. A herd of mountain goats is being airlifted out of Olympic National Park in Washington State after the beast developed an insatiable thirst for human sweat and urine. The park lacks the natural salt needed by the goats, an invasive species, so they try to satisfy their sodium craving by licking the sweat and urine off of hikers and campers, sometimes approaching people aggressively. The horned animals have become such a danger to walkers that the National Park Service has begun tranquilizing the goats, placing them in harnesses, and having them flown by helicopter to a nearby forest. Thank you for your indulgence. We'll go to another column. This is from Germany. Steadfast Chancellor won't break. Don't count German Chancellor Angela Merkel out just yet, said Jen Fleischhauer. Infighting in her unwieldy ruling coalition, made up of Merkel's center-right Christian Democratic Union, is its Bavarian partner, the Christian Social Union, and the center-left Social Democrats, has pundits once again predicting the collapse of the government. And that chatter has only increased in the past week, since the CDU and CSU dumped Volker Kauder, the bloc's parliamentary leader, and Merkel's right-hand man. If you search online for the words Merkel and beginning of the end, you'll get an avalanche of hits. But you'll also see hits from 2 years ago, 7 years ago, and probably all the way back to Merkel's swearing-in 2005. Yet despite so many beginnings, the end never comes. Merkel sails through it all. She endures even the greatest catastrophes with stoic serenity, never getting rattled. Even gross insults, such as when Russian President Vladimir Putin let his black Labrador approach the famously dog-phobic chancellor in 2007, she takes with Buddhist equanimity. That doesn't mean she forgives, of course. She doesn't. She just won't show emotion. The men in German politics find this maddening, and they crack, losing their tempers and the political argument. It's an interesting reversal of stereotype. And finally, a column from Russia titled, The Future is Ours in Asia. The world is focusing on political shenanigans in the U.S. and Europe, said Fyodor Luskyanov, but the real centers of power have moved eastward. Sure, it's entertaining to talk about the president who consorts with porn stars and his subordinates stealing documents off his desk, or about the British conspiracy theorists who believe in Russian plots to poison ex-spies. But over here in the much more boring real world, monumental changes are happening. A huge Danish container ship just finished a journey from Vladivostok on Russian eastern coast to the northern European port of St. Petersburg, traveling the Arctic route that Russian icebreakers had cleared. That means that dreams of an alternative to the Suez Canal are now reality, and global geopolitics will shift focus to the east and to the north. For some 300 years, Russian politics has been focused westward on Europe and across the Atlantic. No more. China, with its Belt and Road Global Infrastructure Initiative, is busy creating trade routes all across Eurasia, and Russia can take advantage of those. Europe is but one end of our continent, the Eurasian continent. There are great opportunities opening up for Russia. We are on the cusp of becoming aware of ourselves as a key Eurasian power. Time for our in-depth article, the last word feature. This week, the title is A Meal Kit for Dinner. HelloFresh set out to disrupt the global food business with prepackaged dinner ingredients, said Bert Helm. Then the German company got to the U.S., and its ruthless strategy collided with reality. Dominic Richter is not a chef, a gourmand, or a food snob. It's a Tuesday in March, and the 32-year-old in a hoodie has chosen to lunch at a kale and juice joint that could easily make you think you're in Los Angeles, except it's in Berlin. But rather than opine over the lactose-free yogurt dressing on the super green detox salad, Richter is stabbing his pumpkin seeds and lettuce as if to establish dominance over the leafy prey. It's tough to discern whether Richter, the co-founder and CEO of HelloFresh, known for delivering the ingredients for Instagram-perfect home-cooked meals like Argentinian-style cod with almond herb chimichurri and chicken thighs in kimchi sauce with Asian pear slaw, and now the number one meal kit company on the planet, actually derives any gustatory pleasure from food. We're in the business of creating meal solutions for different meal occasions, he explains, perhaps thinking I'd never heard before of the concept called dinner. Richter doesn't seem to much care for the social aspect of food either. He's not a fan of work coffees or breakfast meetings or this lunch, for instance. He prefers to put his head down and work. Leading by example, he says with a German-accented lilt, explaining how he's managed to become the king of a brutally competitive industry that at its peak had more than 100 contenders. Being the one that is very structured, very motivated, very hands-on, doing everything that needs to get done. It was likely all these qualities that originally caught the attention of Oliver Samwer back in 2011. The German internet mogul was always prowling for future CEOs. He had a type. MBAs from elite European business schools who had done a few years at investment banks or consulting firms, often with a serious athletic streak, and collected them. Richter checked all three boxes. As one of Samwer's former executives puts it, you could have chosen 100 other guys, same look, same profile. Around the time Samwer decided to activate Richter on his latest venture, the almost billionaire was feeling restless. During the prior 4 years, he and his brothers had amassed a fortune by copycatting overseas startups, building and selling European versions of eBay, YouTube, Groupon, Facebook, and more. Rocket Internet, their four-year-old flagship company, was a veritable clone incubator, having staffed and funded more than two dozen startups. Yet even as his net worth swelled, Samwer was no longer content to just plunder market share from the innovators. He wanted to own entire categories. The time for blitzkrieg must be chosen wisely, he wrote in an email to managers of Home24, one of his clone companies that sold furniture online. Each country tells me with blood when it is time. I am ready anytime. A new category Samwer wanted to test and dominate was meal kits. A Swedish startup called Linas Matkasse sold pre-portioned groceries with corresponding recipe cards that arrived weekly through the mail. In Sweden, the concept had proved extremely popular. HelloFresh, then still under the code name Jade1314, launched from Berlin in October 2011. The meal kit venture was a small bet for Rocket, but for Richter, it was an opportunity to fulfill a vision of himself he'd nurtured since college. He wanted to be a startup founder. Over the years, he'd made attempts. There was his idea for an Airbnb-type site geared to university students and the plan for a campus-based food delivery service. More recently, he and Thomas Griesel, also an MBA and a champion miler and steeplechase runner, had been pitching a daily fantasy sports betting site for professional soccer. But they'd been unable to persuade investors to buy into their dreams. Now Richter had a backer. And better yet, a potentially massive opportunity. If meal kits turned out to be more than a Scandinavian anomaly, he'd be able to disrupt one of the biggest industries in the world, the grocery supply chain. Inside the defunct wholesale bakery in Berlin that now houses HelloFresh's headquarters, the decor is hardly subtle in reminding you that, yes, this is a fresh food company. Farmers market-style green and white striped awnings shelter rows of computer monitors. Farmhouse tables are a folksy contrast to the industrial concrete floors. The co-founder's office is set apart from all this charm. Lofted in the back, inside a sparse, glass-walled conference room, are Richter and Griesel, whom Richter had recruited to help start the company, silently pecking at their laptops in mission control. You'd go up the stairs, and there was a glass container, with Dominic and Thomas sitting in there, not talking to their employees, making sure no one is socially interacting with them, recalls Simon Schminke. In September 2012, the startup was plotting its U.S. takeover. Schminke, one of many executives Rocket kept in reserve as entrepreneurs in residence, was hired to become HelloFresh's new U.S. CEO. In the summer of 2012, HelloFresh sent Schminke to open a new office in New York. The U.S. team, starting out months after other branches, scrambled to catch up. Every Tuesday, the staff woke up before dawn to drive a rental car to New Jersey warehouse and pack meals for the weekly shipment. By the end of the summer, they were delivering food to New York City, and then the tri-state area, and then to the whole eastern seaboard the following year. It was hard and unglamorous work. Later, one intern sued, likening his internship to little more than manual labor for a $1,000 monthly stipend, far less than minimum wage. The case was settled out of court. Employees in the Rocket system were swapped out like tires on a Formula One race car. 9 months into the job, Schminke himself ran into a visa issue. He was dismissed as CEO of the U.S. HelloFresh and replaced by a British executive. Still, the U.S. ops team hustled to go national. By early 2015, they had leased fulfillment centers in Texas and California, enabling the company to ship meals anywhere in the lower 48 states within 2 days. They had also leased a 35,500-square-foot raw warehouse in Linden, New Jersey. It was their first time setting up and operating a warehouse all on their own. For the team of operations managers, this was an exciting step. The managers were running a tight-knit group. Many were in their 20s, had graduated from elite colleges like Princeton and Northwestern, and were working their first jobs building a business from scratch. It was ungodly amounts of work, but we were motivated by a vision that we were going to write the playbook for how you ship these crazy meal kits, said one of the managers. After they signed the Linden lease, the team set up the new operation over the 2014 Christmas holiday. The next 2 months were grueling, installing equipment and assembly lines, and hiring a new staff, all while shipping thousands of meals kits every week. In March, Griesel and another German manager, a former McKinsey & Company consultant named Adrian Frenzel, arrived from Berlin to tour the warehouse and assess the team's progress. We were happy, thinking they're going to be excited because we'd done it all so fast, says another manager. But that wasn't how the Germans responded. Instead, Frenzel launched into all the things wrong about the facility, down to the unswept dust in a corner of the warehouse floor. Frenzel declined to comment. The U.S. ops team was nonplussed. Any person could walk in here and find 50 things wrong, said the second manager. That's a new staff. We're growing like crazy. The German's blunt style rankled the workers. Let's say somebody unloads a container by hand, says the second manager. That's a lot of work. And you'd have the Germans standing there, literally with their arms folded, watching. Then, when anyone's finished, they'd say, the manager affects a German accent. Do another one. They treated them like animals. By early June 2015, five of the American ops managers, including the chief operating officer, had quit. It was hard to see the vision anymore, the first manager says. Frenzel stepped in and took over the COO's duties full time. He hired a new warehouse manager, a former Navy supply officer who shared his top-down approach. Morale plummeted. Order at the facility began to unravel, creating a sense of lawlessness. It was a free-for-all, says one former employee. People would come to work late and high, or go into the bathroom and hide their beer in the ceiling and drink in the bathroom, says a former employee. In the summer of 2015, staff used drugs and drank alcohol in the open, according to three employees who witnessed these activities or found empty bottles and drug paraphernalia on the premises. If you live in a major city, chances are at some point you've been hounded, cornered, or harassed on the street by what one former Dutch HelloFresh customer dubbed Food Jehovah's. Translation, Food Jehovah's. If you think the company is aggressive in signing you up, wait till you hear customer stories of trying to quit. In January 2016, the customer in the Netherlands who had tried and failed to get HelloFresh to stop contacting him after canceling the service wrote a profanity-laced Medium post railing against the hyper-aggressive tactics of the startup, comparing HelloFresh to some combination of stalker ex-boyfriend, religious proselytizer, and mobster. HelloFresh, in its assertive way, was attempting to address what has emerged as a fundamental problem with the meal kit business. People quit. Why? Perhaps the novelty wears off, or there's guilt about all the wasteful packaging, or simply because they are too lazy to cook a gourmet meal every night. Whatever the reasons, it turns out the majority of customers ditch their HelloFresh subscriptions after receiving only a few boxes. But now, as HelloFresh and its biggest U.S. competitor, Blue Apron, pass their sixth birthdays, they know what the quit rates, also known as churn rates, really are. While neither company discloses its figures, third parties, including Dan McCarthy, an Emory Assistant Professor of Marketing, and Second Measure, a research firm that analyzes pools of credit and card data, have examined the company's data. Their findings, which largely match up, paint a grim picture. Nearly half of subscribers of both services cancel within a month. Just 20% stay on as long as 6 months, and the numbers dwindle from there. Without marketing, the business is dead, said Eugene Awe of Okchum Advisors, referring to the constant need to replenish the ranks of quitting customers with fresh subscribers. In 2016, Awe was hired to analyze the meal kit business for a conglomerate interested in potential acquisitions. Awe eventually told his client to steer clear of the industry. Revenue growth comes at an astounding cost, he says. Back at the Berlin Cafe, as Richter and I finish our salads, I ask him how the company plans to become profitable by the year end. He's promised as much to the public markets. He locks eyes with me and gets an edge in his voice. We have a lot of experience with starting markets and then basically driving them to profitability over time, he says. The company has never publicly detailed any profitable operation, either globally or in individual markets. We're in over 10 markets right now, and a bunch of markets are already profitable, he says, but won't specify which ones. Basically, over the course of the year, almost all of the markets will have turned profitable. Hence, we will also be profitable. As he talks, he keeps holding my eyes until I blink and look away. But he doesn't elaborate further. Richter has the tunnel vision of an athlete who, like his original benefactor, is willing to accept only one outcome, winning. At 2 o'clock sharp, he excuses himself. I actually have another appointment, he says. A few minutes later, back at the office, I walk by and notice he's upstairs, sitting alone in his glass box, typing intently on his laptop. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Inc. And we're on the Talking Points page, finishing up the hour. We have an article here, Immigrants, Should They Be Self-Sufficient? The Trump administration often appears too incompetent to act on its worst impulses, said Gabrielle Bruni in Esquire.com. But in unveiling a plan that would force immigrants to choose between feeding and housing themselves and their children and being awarded green cards, Trump's anti-immigrant hardliners remind us of the cruelty they are capable of inflicting. The new rule would make receiving any public benefits, including Medicaid, food stamps, public housing, even prescription drug subsidies, count as heavily weighted negative factors in the consideration of green card applications. Ironically, the only immigrants affected by this rule would be legal immigrants. You know, the ones who are waiting in line and doing everything conservatives say they're supposed to do. Why punish these families for getting a hand as they build new lives? It's not cruel to insist that foreign-born people seeking lives in America should pull their own weight, said Dan Stein in TheHill.com. The Trump administration has merely provided a long-overdue clarification of centuries of American law and tradition that immigrants should be financially self-sufficient. But many recent arrivals work in low-skill, low-wage, agricultural and industrial jobs, and nearly 50% qualify for food stamps and other already overburdened welfare programs. It's time to restore physical sanity and make immigration work for America again. This is modest, sensible reform, said Mark Kerkorian in NationalReview.com. Only people applying for green cards are affected by the new rule, not existing green card holders applying for citizenship. Look, hundreds of millions of people abroad want to move to the U.S. We should only accept those who can pay their own bills. Andrew Carnegie came to this country desperately poor at age 12, said Noah Smith in Bloomberg.com. Like many immigrants, he overcame poverty with talent, grit, work ethic, and ambition. Obviously, not every immigrant will be a fabulously wealthy industrialist or entrepreneur, But study after study finds that immigrants have strong levels of intergenerational mobility and tend to be more entrepreneurial than the native-born. The Trump administration's proposal would exclude immigrants who only need short-term assistance to make ends meet so they can make good in their adopted country. The next Andrew Carnegie might not be able to make it in America because you can't have rags-to-riches stories if you kick out anyone who comes to the U.S. in rags. And a few short notes. More than 20 million people watched the televised Senate testimony from Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford. That's an audience size roughly similar to that of a playoff football game or the Academy Awards. Budget cuts have forced the Internal Revenue Service to slash its enforcement staff by a third since 2011. The rate at which the agency audits tax returns has plummeted by 42% since then, with just 328 criminal referrals in 2016. The IRS estimates that business owners alone cheat the government of $125 billion in taxes every year. About 700 grizzly bears currently live in the vicinity of Yellowstone National Park. When the animal was first placed on the Endangered Species Act list, only about 125 were known to be living in the area. Last winter, 80,000 Americans died of the flu and related complications, the most since the winter of 1976-77, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Only about 47% of Americans elect to receive flu vaccinations. And we'll finish with a quote from Bob Dylan. Steal a little and they throw you in jail. Steal a lot and they make you king. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.